Richard Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique. Never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Saturday, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Richard Skipper Celebrates. This is the show in which I celebrate artists and their body of worth. Now, today's show is going to be a little bit different from most of the shows that I've done, and this comes from an idea that was presented to both Tim and myself by our mutual friend, Mary Lotte. And of course, I'm talking about Tim Moss. I don't think there's a person in the cabaret scene or the LGBTQ community who doesn't know who this man is. I thought I was ubiquitous, but this man has me beat by several miles. Well, in any case, about 5 weeks ago, Mary Lotte and I, Mary Lotte, Tim Moss, and myself were all doing a reading of a wonderful play by our friend Antonia Casper. And we were just talking afterwards, and Mary Lotte said, "You know, Tim, you and Richard should do a show in which you celebrate each other." And I thought, why not? So that's what we're going to do today. For the first part of today's show, since this is my platform, I choose to go first. I get to interview Tim. And then afterwards, Tim is going to sit down and ask me questions. If any of you have any comments that are watching, by all means, put your comments in the comments section. And perhaps Tim and I will respond to those questions or ask the questions that you have for us. I want to begin by saying that it was 317 days ago that all of the theaters shut down in New York. Yeah. And of course, that meant the cabaret rooms and all of the performing venues that both Tim and I not only frequent, but perform in. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of people, everything came to a screeching halt. Not for Tim. Tim got rolled up his sleeves. He got out there. He started creating, and he creates a lot. Tim, before we begin delving into all the work that you do, I want to ask, and I know that you and I actually see each other virtually, of course, every week because we're in a book group together. But I want to ask you, how are you doing really in the midst of this crazy world we find ourselves in?
Well, firstly, Richard, thank you so very much. I am thrilled to be on Richard Skipper Celebrates. Mm-hmm. I am so excited about this. I think overall, I've been doing very well throughout this entire madness. I had one night where I had a meltdown, but that was really it. I had a roommate, and she had went back to Canada shortly after the lockdown in last March. And my next door neighbor had died, and he had been my next door neighbor for almost 40 years. And so that was one part of it. The other part, we didn't know that much about the disease at the time. We didn't know if he died of COVID or not. And I still never got confirmation if it was COVID, but that killer disease could have been just on the other side of my kitchen wall. That was the second aspect. And the third aspect was that he was isolating alone by himself and had been there. They hadn't found him for a couple of days. And my thought was, I'm isolating all by myself. God forbid, in a couple of weeks, they're pounding my door down to come in and find me. So all three of those elements hit me all at once. And that was really the only time throughout all of this that I really felt fear and concern and confusion. But other than that, I'm just taking it with a grain of salt. I'm quite busy. I'm grateful to be very busy and just doing my thing.
Now, I want to go back before COVID actually hit our community in New York City with the shutdown and everything. Was there ever a night where you were just at home? Because, I mean, I follow you on social media and I see you everywhere. You do red carpets. You have your own cabaret show. You are also a film actor because you do a lot of film work. And we will talk about your new film that you recently did. All the things that you've done. But is there ever a night where you say, I'm just going to stay home tonight? I don't feel like going out.
very, very rarely pre-COVID.
Yes.
Quite literally, I would leave in the morning with a bag, like a costume bag, because I would have an appointment over here. I would have a rehearsal over there. Then I would be going over to this nightclub to make an appearance and sing a song. And then I'd have to go over to another club and host some show. And I would get back at about, 2 o'clock in the morning. And then I would get up the next day and do it all over again. And I was having a ball. What is strange is a couple months ago, a friend of mine had come in to town. This is during COVID. And he was saying he had never seen New York City. So I said, well, let's go to Times Square and to Rockefeller Center. We went down there and it was just empty. It was like out of a Stephen King novel or something. Mm-hmm. And then we went over to Rockefeller Center and we were the only two people there. It was very weird, very bizarre. But while we were sitting there, I was like, okay, so we went to Times Square and we came over here. I'm exhausted. I was like, I'm going home. And just from doing those two things, I'm so out of practice. I was like, I used to come down, do this, run around, run to the East Side, go downtown for dinner to meet somebody, then go over to this club, then go over and perform at this other club, and then come home. Like, I would not be able to do that right now.
You're describing what my life was really like in the 20s. And people have heard me say this. I hit all the piano bars in one evening any of them as I possibly could. And then I would retrace my steps. And I did that, I think, throughout all of my 20s until I met Danny and we settled down and a whole different world for me. But where does that come from for you? Were you always outgoing? Did this start where you grew up? Did this come as a result of your moving to New York? Where does it come from?
Well, it's a rather long story, but I will try to give you the abridged version. I grew up in the Midwest. I was always very active and always doing 100 things at one time. Mm-hmm. But then after I moved to New York, I explained this in my cabaret show. I went down the rabbit hole of addiction and developed a massive drug and alcohol addiction over the course of 20 years that by all accounts probably should have killed me. And during that whole time, I was just stagnant. I would do all the partying at home. I was here. I would never go anywhere. I would never do anything. And I just remember thinking, oh, one of these days.
You were imbibing, alone, not with other people?
A lot of times, yeah. A lot of times. A lot of times both. A lot of times by myself, and a lot of times I was the supplying for half the block, it seemed like.
Oh.
What helped pull me out was once I stopped, my memory started to return because I was an amnesiac. I had lost all my memories because of a brain atrophy.
Wow.
From just too much alcohol and drugs over the years. And once my memory started to return, one of the first ones was, oh my God, I'm an entertainer. I'm a singer. I had forgotten for 20 years that I was an entertainer. And so I thought, let me just get back out there and see. And as soon as
you talk about this in your show, you were working for, was it a temp agency that you were working for?
No, I owned a real estate. I got manipulated into a real estate. Yeah. Which I owned and oh God, I didn't like it. But, but once that beautiful memory that once I remembered, I'm an entertainer, mm-hmm. and I started taking steps to get back into it. I was just like, I'm going to crawl. Then I started walking and then I was running. I was just, I am having a ball. I remembered who I was because the path before me started to light up. And I was like, this is where I belong. This is who I am. Thank you, God. Thank you, universe, for reminding me of that. Because that's what I needed.
Well, you're one of the lucky ones that came through, Dad. Yes. I grew up, my father was an alcoholic. It took his life at 67, which is right on the horizon a few years from now for me. Yes. But what was the rock bottom moment for you that you said, okay, enough of this? And how were you able to get through that?
Oh, wow. That's a really hard question for me to answer because I never hit a rock bottom in a way. I basically came face to face with death. I knew if I continued and took even a couple more steps down this road, that it was the end of the line for me. Because it felt, I also mentioned in my cabaret show, it felt like I was standing on the edge of this bottomless cliff. And if I would have taken one or two more steps, I would not be here. And my body would have shut down. I could sense it. I could tell. And I had to change course, which I had no idea how to do that. And that's when I checked into rehab.
Now, I want to talk a moment about your cabaret show, because you did choose to put this on stage, mm-hmm. and you were very honest, brutally honest in some scenes. Mm-hmm. Where did you find the courage to be able to go in front of an audience and do that? Did you go through AA or any 12-step programs to get you to the point where it was comfortable for you to go on stage and talk about these things?
Firstly, I was not comfortable. That's kind of why I did it. Mm-hmm. I had done some of the rooms, but what worked for me, I had found a spiritual group called Unity that kind of helped fill that part of my spiritual reawakening. Mm-hmm. And I had always wanted to do a legitimate cabaret show. So I got together with Lenny Watts and Andrew Sotomayor, and the three of us together, oh my God, mm-hmm. what an amazing, amazing group of minds.
Great synergy.
And Lenny is the one that just started saying, what do you want to say? What do you want to talk about? And he goes, well, what have you been through in your life? And I was like, well, this, and I also had this addiction. And he goes, really? Because nobody believes that I had went down that road.
Are there many people in your life from that period in your life that are still in your life now?
No. Oddly enough, I ran into one on my way on a crosstown bus the other day, the one that I hadn't seen in years. And it was just very odd and awkward.
And you recognized each other with your mask on?
Oh, yeah. 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 Yeah.
Because I know you wear your mask out when you go in public. Very important, everybody.
Yes, absolutely. But Lenny, I think, was the one that really kind of helped pull it out. And believe me, those rehearsals, there were times where I was just a crying mess on the floor. I was just, oh, my God, I don't. Because I was like, I don't know if I can sing this song.
Let me ask you this. Why did you choose to go the route of doing this as a cabaret show as opposed to doing this in a bigger arena as a one-man theater piece?
Well, I don't know. I didn't really have that opportunity presented to me. I was more familiar with the cabaret, mm-hmm. and I wanted to do a cabaret piece that had some depth to it. You know, I wanted to do something that hopefully people could feel. And mm-hmm. oh my God, afterward I would have people coming up crying on my show, like, you know, I can relate. I went through a similar thing, or you know, it really got amazing results from the audiences. It was wonderful. And then I took it out on the road. I've done it out in Palm Springs and across the country.
Are the audiences different? I mean, with this piece, I mean, it's very much a theater. It's your journey of coming to New York, mm-hmm. and what you went through to become an entertainer in New York. Does the energy feel the same for you when you're performing in places such as Palm Springs and the other places you've taken it?
Yes. Yeah, I would say so, because the whole point of the show is people have no idea that I am going to take them down that road. And you hear gasps, you hear crying. I hear, you know, cheers. I hear, you know, it's really quite amazing. It's really quite amazing how it does touch the audience, that they are affected by it. Mm-hmm. Which that's what I was hoping for. That's what, and I'm grateful for that.
And as I said at the beginning of the program, you are so involved in so many different areas in this business, and you are so outgoing and being out there. How did that all begin for you in New York? I know it takes baby steps, but all of a sudden it's like I hear Timos, 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 Timos everywhere I go. And I say that respectfully. That's a good thing. But how did that all come about?
I'm trying to recall. I think you'll have to excuse New York City.
That's New York, everyone.
I was asked to the LGBT center in the Bronx had closed. They had had a whole scandal and this horrible thing had happened and they wanted to restructure it. So someone had asked me if I would be the president to try to get this started and get it up off the ground. And that was how I got into the LGBT. And I also would perform at like different Bronx LGBT events. Well, that opened the door to a lot of politicians. That's where I started meeting like all of the politicians around the city and got to know some wonderful people that are really trying to make changes. And even like the Speaker of the City Council, Corey Johnson, I've known him for years. Seeing their careers go up and the advance has been wonderful, has really been nice, enjoyable to watch. And at the same time, my career, both as an entertainer, that's where my heart really lies. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I kind of learned LGBT activism.
You were not really an activist before you were asked to be the president of the LGBTQ center in the Bronx. Am I right?
Right. Uh-huh. But now I'm on every list in town, you know, and including like the mayor, you know, I'll go to Gracie Mansion for the LGBT celebration in June and Pride Month. And
hopefully we'll have that back this year.
What's that?
I said, hopefully we'll have that back this year.
Crossed.
I mean, well, what is it, you know, as an activist, and I mean, this past year to me has been an explosion of good, bad, indifferent, everything. Mm-hmm. I think we've experienced every emotion known to man in the past 12 months.
Yeah,
what do you really embrace or like about being an activist? And what are some of the things that you absolutely abhor?
The things that I love about the activism is seeing actual change occur. Like not necessarily a phone call that I might make, but as a group of us that we might present legislation or suggest legislation that we will see will eventually come about and turn around that changes people's lives for the better, mm-hmm. you know, and I even in some ways, I'm not like on a national level, but in some ways I'm kind of distantly. And just even things like the trans in the military getting kicked out. I tried to help out a couple friends of mine from Philadelphia that have mm-hmm. an organization called My Brother's House, which is an organization that helps veterans. And they have different houses around the country where they can house different veterans. Well, when that happened, all of a sudden they were going to get hit with a wave of people that many in trans, they transitioned while they were in the military, so they couldn't go home. A lot of times they weren't welcome at home.
Right. That's right.
Where are they going to go? What are they going to do? I mean, it was just such a horrible, I mean, just to even think about doing that, you know, that is the downside. Are when we have fought so hard to make progress and changes, and then to see the backsliding the past few years was just horrifying, and I felt so helpless, and I just felt like all that energy, you know, just had been for nothing, a lot of times. But we're back and pushing forward and pushing ahead.
That's so. The life of an activist. I mean, for every step you take forward, it seems like there are two steps backwards. Mm-hmm. Now, before we do run out of time for this portion of the show, I do want to talk about Junk, which is the film that you are starring in.
Yeah.
First of all, how did that come about? I know that because of COVID, probably the way that it was going to unfurl and roll out is probably very, very different now. So let's go back to how Junk came about and tell everyone a little bit about what the story is about.
Well, Junk is, it was a play, a musical that Michael Penny, who is a brilliant writer, he composed the music, he wrote the lyrics, he did the script, he decided he was going to make a movie and directed it and edited and just, I mean, it's his baby. Michael Penny is just remarkable, remarkable human being. A friend of mine, David Stallings, who is in was having a theater festival here in New York City several years ago, and he said that this writer from North Carolina had this play, and we thought, oh, you would be perfect for the role of Miss Lily. Hmm. My first thought was Miss Lily. Okay, just because I'm gay, I've got to put on a wig, I got to come out and say two lines to make everybody laugh because that's all gay people do, and. But I like David. So I said, sure, I'll do this for you. Just send me the script. So he sent me the script and it was page one, Miss Lily, Miss Lily, Miss Lily. I kept turning the page and it was Miss Lily, Miss Lily. Oh my God, this is an actual role. And for a middle-aged gay man, I don't get offered lead roles often.
Excuse me. are you outing yourself today on national? So, you know,
honey, if you can't tell by now, so I did the reading and the music was very sophisticated. I was pulling my hair out. I was just like, oh my God, I don't know if I can do this. But the night came and it went off amazing. Mm-hmm. It was just a one night staged reading. And I had every straight man in that audience, and there was a lot of them, come up afterwards and say, you made me cry in that last scene. Wow. So I told Michael, I pulled him to the side and I said, you've really got a product here. You've really got something here that touches people. And so he went his way. I went mine. Then he went out to Palm Springs and they put it up on stage. And it's a two-person show. There's only Miss Lily and Chris are the two characters. So I went about my thing. About a year or two later, I get this message from him and he says, you know, I got some good news for you. And I was like, I like good news. What you got? And he says, we're going to make Junk into a movie and I want you to star in it. And I was like, yeah, that's good news. The good news.
Did you think it would actually come to fruition or did you always believe that this would happen?
As soon as he mentioned it, it was on. I was like, I will do anything and everything you need for this. I had confidence in the script. I had confidence in him. It was an opportunity for me that doesn't come along very often.
Now, and you filmed in North Carolina, am I correct?
Yes, we shot in outside of Durham, in a basically a ghost town. Mm-hmm. It was right on the railroad, but they discontinued that stop, so it was like a little town. There was a train depot, a general store, a hotel, which is what the building that we shot in, and then this little shack beside it that just said Mary Oaks Post Office. And it was at the end of a dead-end road out in the countryside. So we had the whole place to ourselves. It was amazing, amazing experience.
Now, had you done a lot of film work prior to this, or was this a new experience for you?
No, I had done a lot of independent films before. But one of the things is, on the smallest independent films that I had worked on, the crew itself, you had a minimum of like 15 to 20 between the cinematographer and the costumer and the makeup artist and this one and that one and the producer and the director. I get down there and there are seven of us, seven people, cast and crew. And we decided we were going to stop at nothing to get this done. So it became a very family style film. Where we all took on different jobs. Like I was kind of in charge of continuity and Robbie would do the choreography and you'd move a sandbag if you needed to, you move the lights wherever you need to, you know, we all just pitched in and did what we needed to do to get the shot.
Did you film in a continuous form or did you jump around?
It was pretty continuous, except the finale. Or the final scene, there was one night that we knew it was going to rain and it was cold and rainy, but we knew with the tap, 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 tap on the ceiling, we couldn't shoot inside. So we decided, why don't we just shoot the final scene outside in the cold
and in the rain
and in the rain and, yeah, getting soaked and doing take after take after take. But we did it. We thought this is our opportunity. The final scene would look amazing in the rain. So let's just do it. And we did. There was a lot of that. But we would not move on to the next shot unless everybody signed off on it. Like, we would go around the room. Okay, was that good for you? Good for you? Good for you? Good for you? And, like, if I said, no, I really didn't, I'd like to do it a different way. And we'd, okay, let's do it. But if I said, yeah, I'm good, and the sound guy was like, no, I had a little bit. Okay, do it again. We'll just keep doing the scene over and over until everybody was satisfied.
And where can everybody see this film? I know that it's going to be coming up soon on this movie night you were telling me about.
Yes.
So people will be able to see this. Tell everyone a little bit about that.
Well, I'm also working with a new network that is starting out, which is called UBC. It stands for Urban Broadcasting Company. And they're expanding and growing. And I mean, it like to Sling and Crackle and Pluto, and it's going on several major platforms. So it's really going to be growing and expanding very quickly. And we decided, Peggy Dotson, who owns UBC TV, had seen Junk, and she wanted to have a movie night to launch their pay-per-view channel. Mm-hmm. And she also has a new technology from Israel, I believe it is, which is kind of like a virtual reality, but you don't need the helmet. It'll be on the television. Like, you can be here in New York and a friend of yours in Palm Springs or out in California, you can be in the same room watching it together, and you can be chatting back and forth while you're watching the movie. So you can have chat rooms set up. There'll be, or your vantage point if you want to sit up in the balcony and look down on it, or, you know, it should be really, really cool. But it's UBC TV, Urban Broadcasting Company. The name of the film is Junk, J-U-N-K. And as of right now, we're shooting for, it hasn't been confirmed, but we're shooting for Thursday, April 22nd.
And you can post this on my Twitter page, on Facebook.
Oh, thank you.
As we get closer, anything I can do to help get the word out.
Thank you.
Before we switch gears, as per Mary Lottie's suggestion, is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't cover?
No, not really. I mean, I, you know me, I'll talk about anything or nothing. So I'm great. What I'm really hoping for out of this pandemic, I'm really hoping that people have, I think we're going to come out on the other side as changed people. And I'm hoping that people embrace the change for good, where we're a little more loving, we're a little more understanding of each other, where we're hopefully as a society that we can join together, because I have a feeling we're going to have amazing opportunities, because like the real estate in New York City, there's a lot of empty space right now. A lot of the businesses have discovered that people can work from home. They don't need. And so I think there's going to be a shift, which opens up all kinds of opportunities for businesses and small companies and restaurants and clubs and performance spaces. And I'm actually getting quite excited about the possibilities.
But you have to be open to that.
Yeah,
I mean, some people still resist everything.
Absolutely. But,
you know, that's the story. Well, Tim, I've enjoyed interviewing you. I want to have you back where I have a full hour devoted to you. As I said, this was an idea that Mary Lottie came up with. So now we're shifting gears. And Artist Exposed, everyone, how many interviews have you done on Artist Exposed?
Actually, I had my 500th episode, but a lot of times within episodes, there's several interviews, you know, from different people. Like, if it's a red carpet, I can talk to like 10 or 15 different people, you know?
Wow.
So I have no idea interview-wise, but episodes, I've got five. I'm celebrating my 500th. Right now,
I'm going to do everything I can to catch up with you. And now we're shifting gears.
Welcome to Richard Skipper Celebrates. My name is Tim Moss. And for the next 25 minutes?
Half hour.
I am going to be interviewing Richard Skipper himself. Yay.
No, I do want to say it's difficult for me to let go. I mean, you we have not discussed anything that we were going to talk about today. Everything that we are talking about is off the cuff. Do not try this at home. We are professional.
Well, one thing I want to ask you real quick, right off the top, have you ever had like any interviews that where people, it's like pulling teeth, where you just have to like yes or no answers? Mm-hmm. That will be a first question then, will be like, how do you stretch that? Because for me personally, a lot of times, like when you ask them, you know, oh, so how was that Broadway show with all of those fabulous costume changes that ran for 2 years? Fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you something. Today, as we're filming this today or doing this live, Larry King passed away.
Yes.
And there is a very famous episode in which Larry King had Robert Mitchum on the show.
Hmm.
And no matter what he asked him, the answers were, yep.
Oh, my God.
Nope. Yep. Nope. And they went to a commercial break. And Larry King said, you got to give us a little bit more to work with. And he says, okay. They come back for the commercial break. So did you enjoy working with Jane Russell in this film? Yep. And it was like pulling teeth. You know, and it's very, very interesting. I don't want to talk about it here because I don't want to out the person.
Don't mention.
But I had a situation where, it was almost as if that person was like a deer in headlights.
Oh, yeah.
Watching. I was truly trying to keep the story going. And you and I, that's what we do. You don't want the dead space. So you do whatever you can to get to the next question. Yep. And that and of course my eyes kept darting to the timer because, and I will say, I don't like to do a show that's longer than an hour. If it's going to be an hour and 5 minutes or something like that, that happens sometimes. But I don't think when you go longer than an hour, and I say this out of all respect to all that do go longer, I don't think it's fair to your artists that are sitting, giving of their time, number one. And I don't think it's fair to the audience because the audience is there to support both you and the person that you're interviewing.
Right.
And when you keep someone for a long period of time, I think it's not fair to your guest or the audience. Mm-hmm.
Well, I would have kind of an advantage on that because a lot of times I'm on the red carpet where if I did something like that and they have nothing to say, I'd be like, you heard it here right first, folks. Bye. Which is always nice. Well, again, my name is Tim Moss. You're watching Richard Skipper Celebrates, and I am interviewing the man himself, Richard Skipper. Mm-hmm. Now, you are an award winner, you four-time Mac Award, Bistro Award. You are a master entertainer, MC and host. You had public relations. And you've done over 1,000 interviews, is that correct?
Yes.
Wow, impressive. So,
you know, it's interesting because when I stopped performing as Carol Channing, some people know me in that persona. Yeah. I did that for 20 years. And then even before that, I performed for a few years as Judy Garland, believe it or not. There's pictures on Google, look it up. But when I stopped performing as Carol, I was thinking about what the next chapter was going to be in my life. This is a true story. I was in Palm Springs. I'm going to drop a name. We were visiting Carol Channing. And Carol and I were sitting on the sofa. And I was saying, I think it's time for me to move on. She was always supportive of me. But she always said, as wonderful as you are, and thank God she thought I was wonderful doing it, she said, people don't know who you are because you're hiding behind me. You need to step out and the world needs to know Richard Skipper. And I was trying to figure out what the next step was going to be in my life. And Carol suggested that I write a book celebrating the women who have played Dolly. She said, you know more about that show than anyone other than Jerry Herman and myself. Yeah. And I went on Facebook, and I mean, even back then, and I said, I'm thinking of writing a book about Hello, Dolly. I'm telling you, this is a true story. And then someone said, well, if you're writing a book about Hello, Dolly, you should interview Roberta Olden. Roberta Olden was Ginger Rogers' assistant at the end of Ginger's life, Miss Rogers' life. And some people may or may not know this. Ginger Rogers replaced Carol Channing in the original run of Hello, Dolly. So I said, well, do you have any idea how I can reach Roberta Olden? And they said, she's in Palm Springs. I was in Palm Springs at the time.
Oh, my God.
So I said, well,
I love synchronicity.
So they put me in touch with Roberta Olden, and she agreed to meet me. But she wanted to meet me on neutral territory. She didn't want me coming to her house. Mm-hmm. She didn't know me.
Right.
I really had not sat down to interview anyone before. So I didn't know what was going to come out or anything. Mm-hmm. So we ended up meeting at a country club. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of those in Palm Springs, as you know. So we met at this country club. And what surprised me was that Roberta Olden was my age. She worked with Ginger Rogers at the end of Ginger Rogers' life. And we sat and we started, and I got my little tape recorder out and I started to record her. And then she said, can we stop the interview? And I thought, oh my God, this is it. I stopped the interview. And she said, we need to come back to my house because I've got things I need to share with you.
Oh my God, how fabulous.
And we went back to her home, and Ginger Rogers' Dolly dress was in the closet. Ginger Rogers, actually, you know, I live in Rockland County. The next little hamlet next to where I live is Sneeden's Landing. Mm-hmm. When Ginger Rogers was doing Dolly, she lived in Sneeden's Landing.
Oh my goodness.
And she did all of these. She loved to draw. She was a great artist. Carol Channing, too, by the way. Uh-huh. And she also shared with me her mom, Ginger Rogers' mother, kept a journal. Mm-hmm. And so she had very detailed accounts of Ginger Rogers' opening night and her closing night, mm-hmm. As well as other stories throughout that she had kept. And Roberta Olden, thank you. She opened everything up to me. And little by little, that's how it began.
Uh-huh.
I would interview someone and they would say, you need to talk to someone.
Right. Uh-huh. And that organically happening like that means it's supposed to happen. It's meant to be. Now, you and I are so much alike in so many different ways.
Are you bragging or complaining?
No, it's... No, firstly, you have a milestone, your 60th birthday coming up. Very soon, in a matter of weeks,
I think.
Yes, and I'm right behind you in May, okay. My 60th. Now, you've been here in New York for 41 years?
42. This year marks 42 years, yes.
Okay. It's 39 for me, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 39. And now you grew up in Conway, South Carolina, right. Small town. I grew up in a small town, or actually in the countryside of Indiana. So we grew up in the 60s and the 70s in small town America. Mm-hmm. And I kind of know what that's like, unless you were surprisingly the football star of the town or something that I didn't
know. A lot of people might be surprised to know that I was the head quarterback on our baseball team.
I was right in there with you, walking right in there with you. But where I grew up, they would always say, you know, like a teacher, for example, that was in his 30s and he was living by himself. You know, he's a little odd. They would always whisper, you know, where he's fancy. So when did you discover or come to terms with the fact that you were fancy? the coming out process to the family.
I was probably the most asexual person to come out of the state of South Carolina. I didn't know anything about it. I mean, if I did, And even now, it was suppressed in the back of my brain. Mm-hmm. And I came to New York. It all happened. Excuse me, I've got a tickle in my throat. It all happened when I was 21. And by the time that I came to the realization that this is who I am, front page headlines every single day in the paper was the gay cancer. Gay were dying of AIDS. Mm-hmm. And it was called the gay cancer before they had a name for it.
Right.
Excuse me. And then it was called SIDS, if you remember that. Yep. And then,
And then HIV into ARC, into AIDS, full-blown AIDS.
Interesting thing. I came to New York in 1979. I was 18 years old.
Wow.
And as I look back on this period, I think that everything happens for a reason. I believe, thank God, that I didn't know, because mm-hmm. I am a very outgoing person, and I probably would have been, our mutual friend, Michael Musto, mm-hmm. was a club kid. I mean, that was the world he lived in. Mm-hmm. And excuse me, I've got this tickle. I'm choking up on this. Mm-hmm. If I had known coming to New York and I had jumped into that lifestyle and that world and everything, God only knows if I would be here to talk about it.
Right. Now. You might have ended up a statistic.
I lost some very dear friends. Yeah. I have to say, I mean, people that I worked with, like Dick Gallagher, incredible musical director at Don't Tell Mama and beyond. He wrote Whoop-Dee-Doo and When Pigs Fly. And a few friends that I did lose to AIDS. But I know people who lost lots of friends. I've actually lost more friends to COVID than I did to AIDS. Mm-hmm. Because that was not the world that I was part of.
Right.
I remember, again, when I came, very funny story, and I'm not going to tell all the details. I'll tell you privately some other time. But I worked for the Green Room Answering Service, and there was a guy that was Barbara Streisand used to say she was so far out that she was practically in. And that was Joseph Catalana. He came to work, with his leather vest and everything, because he was going to be going out to the clubs. And he was saying, Richard, come with me. And I'm going, I'm not going to go with you. And I kept pushing that. And then, finally I gave in, I went, I felt comfortable in that space. I became, the piano, the gay bars that I went to at the beginning were piano bars.
Uh-huh.
I could get up and I could sing.
Right.
And I felt welcome in these places. Mm. And I really, for me, it was a comfortable transition. But I'll tell a funny story. I don't know if my sister is watching or not, but this is a very funny story. I got a job working for a company called Tiger Temps. And Tiger Temps was a gay-owned and operated temp agency. Mm-hmm. Everybody that worked in this company, they were all gay or lesbian. And it was a great job to have at that beginning stage where you felt comfortable being who you are. Mm-hmm. It was, so my sister used to call in. My sister has a Southern accent that you can cut with a knife. And she used to call and she'd say, hi, Ricky, I'm calling, and when she would call, we'd put her on the speakerphone, and everyone in the office loved talking to my sister. So she finally plans a trip to New York. It's her first time to come up and visit me. And we are invited, a couple that I worked with, we're invited to their home. So we go to their house for dinner. And on the way there, on the subway, I say to my sister, I want to let you know that they're gay. And she said, well, that's okay. I actually have gay friends. And I said, well, that's nice to know and everything. So we go, we are having dinner. I get up to go to the bathroom. And, one of the guys, Paulo, said to my sister, Ricky's very lucky to have a sister like you. And she's, well, I think so too, but why do you say that? And he said, well, someone who's so open about his lifestyle. She says, yes, he's been doing this since he was 13. She thought they were talking about me being an actor. And so I am on the other side of the wall going, oh my God, I am being outed right now. And they go, what do you mean he's been doing? She said, yes, in high school, everybody knew that this is what he wanted to do. Everybody was accepting of it and everything. And they said, well, what do you think of Craig? She says, Craig? And they said, his boyfriend. She's got a boyfriend. And I came back out. And I mean, my face was so red. And I sat down and we, you know, she, you know, got through dinner. We got on the subway. She doesn't say a word until we get back to my apartment. And she says, well, why didn't you tell me? And I said, well, I didn't know how you were going to react. She said, well, you know, it's okay. Don't worry about it. And the same thing. And then I will tell you the funny story. These are stories that I didn't tell on my show. This is the part two that I have to tell. But my grandmother, Getha Wallace Skipper, my dad's mom, she was my best friend in the world. I love her. I miss her. I think about her. I speak to her every day, still, believe it or not. And so this was, Danny and I had met in going on 32 years ago, but we met. And that first year that we were together, my grandmother, the second year that we were together, my grandmother was dying. And I went home like five times that year. And one night we go to, I'm there and a friend of mine said, let's go to one of the local gay bars. And I said, she said, there's a place and they have what is called, are you ready for this? This is South Carolina, Booger Karaoke.
Okay.
And it was called Booger Karaoke because it was scary karaoke. These people would get up and sing. So we go to Time Out in Myrtle Beach. And my friend signs one of the karaoke cards. And the guy who was the host comes up and he says, well, we got a big surprise for you tonight because Judy Garland is here. Now, which one of you is Judy Garland? And I go, I'm going to kill you. But I got up. I sang as Judy. I brought the house down and I got a paid booking there.
Yeah.
They wanted me to come back a month later. So I booked myself at this bar to come back and perform there. And so my sister, mom, if you're watching, I'm sorry, I'm going to tell this story now. So my sister goes to my mom and dad. I was going on that night around 11 o'clock. So my sister goes and she's, we're going to see Ricky. Now, this is the way my sister tells the story. Uh-huh. And my mom and dad said, we are not going to a gay bar. Mm-hmm. Again, this is South Carolina.
Right.
And my sister said, this is Ricky performing. And if you don't go, I won't speak to you again. So my mom and dad get up and they come to this gay bar.
Goodness.
So I am sitting in the dressing room getting ready to do the show. Danny is sitting in the dressing room and my sister comes in and, you know, she's meeting Danny for the first time and everything. And I said to Danny, you should go out and meet mom and dad. So my mom and dad are seeing their son perform as Judy Garland. They are meeting Danny and they're their first gay bar all in the same night.
What an alternate universe. Oh my God.
All in the same night. So they have all these guys that are there as lookalikes and everything. And there was one guy, this was Madonna in the cone phase. So this guy's walking around serving drinks dressed as Madonna. Danny said this guy that my dad turns to him and says, is that Ricky? And he's going, no, Ricky's starring in the show, you'll know. So, but my parents, God bless them, they were there. Oh. And the next night, my sister and my dad came again.
Oh, how wonderful.
Performance.
Wonderful. Well, actually, we're going to have to do this again because I've still got a whole list of questions.
We've still got time. So I will let you know when we run out of time.
Yes, but one... just real quick, I just want more of a statement than anything, but Dan LaLorge. Okay. Dan LaLorge. I think I first met you when you and Dana did Wednesday Nights at the Iguana. Mm-hmm. And I had interviewed the two of you. And I just want to say thank you to the two, to you and to Dana, God bless her, because you were the first ones to open the door and allow me to come in to sing for the cabaret community.
Serious? Wow. Yeah,
that was the first time that I had ever sang for the cabaret community. So I just wanted to say thank you. Now, my question is, it's a chicken or the egg. Which came first, the chicken or the egg question? Did your incredible passion for the show Hello Dolly come first, or your incredible passion for the entertainer Carol Channing come first?
Carol Channing. My introduction to Carol Channing, and I'm going to put a little plug in here. On the 31st of this month, it is Carol Channing's 100th birthday.
Wow.
And putting together a show called 100 Years of Carol Channing. Yeah. I am doing this as a benefit for the York Theater. I don't know if any of you know this, but the York Theater has had extensive damage due to a flood.
Oh, great.
And so I'm going to do this. I've got Leroy Reams, who, of course, worked with Carol Channing. Yeah. Christine Petty from Sirius XM Radio.
Oh, wonderful.
Jim Morgan from the York Theater. Carol Channing received the Oscar Hammerstein Award mm-hmm. in 2003. And then Enrique Kane Larimer. And I've got some other surprises that I'm not going to talk about right
now.
But it's on the 31st. It will be through this platform. Uh-huh. But very quickly, I'll share this story with you. My introduction to Carol Channing came because on an episode of The Lucy Show, Lucy Ball does an impersonation of Carol Channing. And I was this kid that imitated everything that I saw on television.
Wow.
And my imitation of Carol Channing was actually an imitation of Lucille Ball as Carol Channing.
That's fabulous.
And that's where it began for me. And then shortly after that, I saw Carol Channing. Can I share something with you right now?
Sure, absolutely.
I'm gonna go behind the curtains. Hold on a second here.
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, all of you watching.
So I'm going to share this with everybody. Because this dress was Carol's dress that she wore. There it is.
Oh, my God.
Yes, there it is.
Yes.
And everything. I have a few of her costumes here. I also have a hat that I can't get to right now that she signed. But I saw this television special with Pearl Bailey.
Uh-huh.
And that was my introduction to Carol, and really as a real person. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I moved to New York, and there's so many stories that I could share here. We'll do a whole other show about that. But I had moved to New York, and Len Fontaine had passed away. Mm-hmm. And I heard that they were doing a memorial at the Len Fontaine Theater, and Carol Channing was going to be there. Mm-hmm. And I was dying to see her. By this point, I'm a huge, huge, huge fan. Uh-huh. Anytime I knew that she was going to be on television or anything, I would really tune in to watch her. So I go to the Len Fontaine Theater. I am standing in front of the theater. True story. These I can't believe it. But Carol Channing and Helen Hayes and wow. Fairbanks Jr. are standing in front of the theater. And I am so close to them. And I hear Carol say to Helen Hayes, "I have a table at Sardi's. We're going there in a few minutes for a bite to eat. Would you join us?" And Miss Hayes said, "Yes, I will join you." I ran to Sardi's.
Yeah, that's great.
And I told them at Sardi's that I was a friend of Carol's and I did not want to be seated at her table. I wanted to be seated at the table next to her. Well, they believed me because how would I know that she was coming to her?
Right? Oh, my God.
So I sat there and I watched and I am listening to everything that Carol and Charles and Helen Hayes and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. I was the fly on the wall listening to everything that was going on. And I will say this. It was 20 years later. The years just run together in my head. Uh-huh. I'm having lunch with Carol Channing at the Boathouse at Central Park. And I said to her, and I told her this story.
Oh, she said,
"I always knew you looked familiar." But, you know,
so then quick, so quick.
When she got her star on the Palm Springs Walk of Fame, mm-hmm. and I'm talking to Harry, and I said, I'm thinking of coming out to California. I want to be there when Carol gets this recognition. And I said, do you have any recommendations of where I can stay when I come out there? And he says, well, why don't you stay at the Collegian Channing Hotel? And I said, where is that? And I thought maybe they had a hotel. Yes. He's in our house.
Oh my God. How
I stayed with Carol and Harry. And, you know, it was so funny. We're sitting there when I arrived. He picked me up at the airport. We come back. And Carol was taking a nap in the afternoon. And Harry and I are just sitting on the sofa talking. Carol walks in. And Harry says, Carol, he said, you're not wearing any makeup. She says, Richard loves me the way I am. He doesn't care if I'm wearing makeup.
Love her.
And it was true. I mean, when I walked into her house, it was literally like walking into the museum of the 20th century.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, my dear friend Josh Ellis was her publicist.
Uh-huh.
And he turned me on to what is called Channing art. Mm-hmm. And now I save photos of all my friends, and I call it Skipper art that I stole from Carol. Because Carol had her picture taken with world leaders, presidents, athletes, Broadway stars, movie stars, television stars, personalities that were in the news. She had her picture taken with everybody.
Yeah.
So when we walked into her house, the walls were covered. With all of these incredible photos, and they're giving me a tour of their house.
Hmm.
I go into her office, and on the wall across from the desk is a picture of myself with her. And I said, I am so moved.
Oh my God.
Here. And she said, I see you every morning, whether I want to or not.
Oh, how wonderful. Oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, and I, out of everything that came my way, looking mm-hmm. back over my life, I mean, at almost 60 years of age,
mm-hmm.
and I really, every year, August 5th, which was the day that I came to New York, that to me is a birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Because that, to me, is when Richard was born.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ricky was Conway, South Carolina. Richard mm-hmm. is this person that I've become.
That you evolved into.
That I evolved into, for better or for worse. I'm not perfect. I've got many flaws. Some people know those flaws. Some people don't. But I, the thing is that when I look back over my life, mm-hmm. And I mean this sincerely, and I think it's why I love what I'm doing now, it's the people that I've met along the ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily the awards that I've won or the things that, and I have been very, very fortunate. I appeared at Carnegie Hall. Mm-hmm. I appeared on stage on more than one occasion with Carol Channing.
Mm-hmm.
More than one occasion, she's sitting in the audience. To me, having her as a friend was something that this little kid that used to perform as Carol Channing, again, another story for another time, on the front steps of Conway High School, I never would have believed.
Yeah, yeah, right. What a life. Oh, my God. Because, again, we have got – there is so much.
I see that Valerie Davis is here, and I want to give a shout out to Valerie, because Valerie was the one that suggested that I do something for the York Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I was already putting this show together, celebrating Carol Channing, and I thought this would be the perfect fit. So everyone, I mean, they've lost programs. They've lost fires. If you're able to make a donation to the York Theater,
mm-hmm.
and again, I stress, if you're able to,
right.
By all means, do so. And, you know, so I want to thank you all. We are at the end of the show. We're going to do this again, Tim.
But also callondolly.com. I wanted to mention that, too.
Yeah, that's all the Dollies. And we just added Betty White. Uh-huh. I've been searching everywhere for photographs of her as Dolly. Oh. Someone finally got them to me. I want to thank you, Tim, for being here.
Thank you.
I want to do a whole show where I celebrate you. But I, you know, I end every show by telling everyone, if you enjoyed today's show, and I hope you did, and if you haven't done so already, please go to my guest book, richardskipper.com. Put your thoughts about the show. That helps to boost me in other markets. I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. Mm-hmm. Today, go to your Facebook friends list and go to the fifth name that pops up and reach out to that person with a phone call. Not an email, not a text, not a person, a private message, but a phone call. Let them know what they mean in your life. Now, Tim, I'll give you the final word. Mm-hmm. Anything that you want to expound upon that we talked about today that you want to build on, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish that we had, or just any message that you want to put out to the world right now. And thank you for all you do. You're the best.
Thank you. And likewise, I'm so grateful for this. Thank you very much. This was amazing. I want to leave you with one of my mantras that I came up with. And also just look inside yourself. Within, you have the answers for you. Nobody else has those answers. You have the answers. Trust yourself and trust your heart. But in the first part, in the first half of my life, I was doing what everybody else was telling me to do. They were all telling me, oh, you got to do this and you got to be this and you got to be that. I was basically a supporting role in everybody else's reality. Well, now in the second half of my life, I am starring in my reality.
So, and you're doing a very good job of it, I might add. You know, I do want to let everyone know before we do sign off, and then I've got one other thing that I want to ask you. We are going to go into the just a few minutes over, but tomorrow afternoon evening at 6 o'clock, I'm going to be celebrating Jerry Sager.
Yes.
Do you know Jerry?
I know of her. We've never met.
Uh-huh. Oh, my God. Phenomenal talent. Uh-huh. She's done Broadway. She's done cruise ships. She's mm-hmm. done concerts. She's done cabaret. She's done it all. Mm-hmm. And we're going to celebrate that. Before we go, you told me recently a story that when you were interviewing Robin Bird, and if any of you out there don't know who Robin Bird is, look it up. But I want to leave with the story that Robin Bird shared with you. So if you could do that, and that'll take us off, and everybody make it a better tomorrow.
Certainly. Robin Bird, of all people, she dropped a bit of wisdom, a nugget of wisdom on me that I did not see coming. I was interviewing her and I said, I just want to thank you, you know, because you're a pioneer, you are a trailblazer, you've paved the way. And she said, well, I've just got to tell you, she says, the pioneers get the arrows. The settlers that come later get the houses.
Think about that, everybody.
Yeah.
That's the thought to leave you with today. Love you, Tim.
I love you, too. Thank you.
Goodbye.